Hey gang, do you live in Austin? Are you looking for a new monthly show where you can get exposed to new hip-hop and electronic music? Well, let me tell you about Sundays, presented by Solstice Live. It's a hip-hop monthly taking place the last Sunday of every month at the Vulcan Gas Company from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. The show starts this Sunday, February 28th, with High Minds, The Bishops, Ben Buck, 23 Cups, and Mason Flint. Simply go to solsticelive.com for more info. Sundays at the Vulcan Gas Company, Sunday, February 28th. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
Alright! Hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a fantastic show for you guys today. Producer, singer-songwriter David Messier is here. He has a new album coming out this Friday, February 26th, called Waiting for Eldridge, a fantastic album. And also, he's doing a record release show on Friday, February 26th at the Townsend right here in Austin. Get out there and see it. The album is fantastic. 10 songs produced by the great Eldridge Goins, mastered by the great Bob Ludwig. And has such great guests as Brad Houser, Guy Forsythe, Wendy Colonna, Gary Newcomb, Dave Madden, Steve Bernal. Waiting for Eldridge, available on Friday, February 26th. If you're in Austin, get out to the Townsend. Check out my guest, David Messier. You can find him at davidmessier.com. Great guy. He's also, you know, he owns Same Sky Productions, great studio over here on the east side. I see him in the mornings. Every once in a while, I see him in the mornings. He does a similar time run that I do, and I'll see him on the trail. And I'll be like, hey, David, that's where I found out about the record. I was running one morning, and he was like, hey, I made a record. And I was like, no way. He's like, yeah, I'll send you a link this afternoon. And I heard it, invited him on the show, and now here we are. He's got a record release show this Friday, February 26th, also the same day that the record comes out, Waiting for Eldridge. Get out to the Townsend if you're in Austin. Pick up Waiting for Eldridge by simply going to davidmessier.com. All right? Speaking of shows this week, before we get to my conversation with David Messier, a very dear friend of mine, Jeremy Nail, is performing tomorrow night, Wednesday, February 24th, at the Townsend at 8 p.m. He made a new record produced by Alejandro Escovedo called My Mountain. It comes out in May, but he's performing the record tomorrow night, Wednesday, February 24th, at the Townsend at 8 p.m. with such great people as Chris Masterson, Eleanor Whitmore, Chris Searles. I'm going to get up and sing a song with them. I'm really looking forward to this. Jeremy has overcome some pretty heavy shit, man. We used to be in a band called Liars and Saints together. And during that time, you know, I run in the mornings. He also runs. And he was telling me he was having some knee problems. And he went and checked it out. Turned out it was cancer. And he had to have his leg amputated from below the knee. Or from the knee down. And that's a harrowing thing for a young man, you know? Jeremy's very young. So anyway, he overcame it. He wrote a batch of songs that are very intense, very beautiful. And Alejandro really connected with it. And the record's great. I've gotten to listen to it in his car one drunken night. I think it was my birthday, actually, out at the Seaboys. Anyway, go check it out. Wednesday, February 24th. That's tomorrow at the Townsend at 8 p.m. Jeremy Nail performs My Mountain. Worth seeing. Great room with great sound. Great show. Okay? I had a great weekend. I played with Skyrocket on Friday at Hanover's. Then we played at the 1-to-1 bar on Saturday. Both great shows. We had a really good time. You know, this thing happened to me on Friday that doesn't happen to me as much as it used to, but it was really great to have happen. I played for a couple of hours before I headed out to Hanover's to warm up, and just because I was in the mood to play, like just playing music, playing piano, playing guitar, putting on records and jamming along with them, making up songs, playing songs I already knew, just doing all kinds of just weird stuff and playing. And then I went and played with Skyrocket for 2.5 hours at Hanover's, and when I left at 1 a.m. and I was on my way home, all I could think was like, man, I kind of want to go play some more. I really did. I wanted to go. I didn't want to come back to my apartment where I had to be quiet. I wanted to go to a place and plug in and jam with my friends. Maybe same people I was jamming with, maybe new people. Who cares? I just wanted to play. So that was a good feeling. I also kind of felt like that on Saturday, but I was still a little tired. That was a long show. Had a good time. Spent Sunday not doing a lot of stuff. I was supposed to go out and see Brandon Temple last night because he's coming in this week on the show, but I fell asleep last night at like 8. Yeah, that happens, man. I'm ashamed of it. It's not something I'm proud of, but some days after a string of gigs and then all of a sudden, like, you hang out all day on Sunday and then you lay down, start watching a show, and next thing you know, you wake up, it's like 3 a.m. Anyway, had a good night's sleep, feeling good, doing podcasts all week. I'm not playing this week with Skyrocket, just doing some different stuff, doing some writing. I start a new songwriting game this week with some people. It's very intense. It's like a 12-week songwriting thing where you write 12 songs, a song a week. But if you don't finish, you get kicked out. I was in it a couple of years ago, and I did not turn in a song, and I got kicked out. So, yeah, look for 12 new songs from me. I'll be posting them on SoundCloud, you know, if they're good. So check those out, okay? All right, let's get to my conversation with the great David Messier, the guy who owns Same Sky Productions, great studio on the East Side, putting out his very first solo album, Waiting for Eldridge, available this Friday, February 26th at davidmessier.com, iTunes, and all the places. But go to davidmessier.com for all the info. Also, doing a record release show Friday, February 26th at the Townsend. So get out and see that. I'm off this Friday. I'm going to get out and I'll be there. I'll be at the Townsend. I'm going to be at the Townsend a lot this week. Tomorrow night, Wednesday, February 24th, get out and see Jeremy Nail. On Friday, February 26th, get out and see David Messier. All right? It's going to be a great time. Have a great week. I'll be thinking about you. Maybe I'll see you somewhere. Enjoy yourself. Enjoy my conversation with the great David Messier. Pick up his album, Waiting for Eldridge. All right? Have a great week. Let's get down.
Don't say nothing, my friend. Words won't lie. Stay till the end, 'cause we gonna ride, we gonna ride, we're going to ride.
Oh God, dude, he is like,
hey now,
and you know when he that episode where he does the Vegas show and he wants to rehearse on stage.
Yeah.
Can I use the stage for rehearsals? And everyone's kind of tolerating it. And Artie asks him in the hallway, how's it going, Hank? You know? And and Hank says, oh, Artie. He's like, we're opening with a Latin version of Spinning Wheel. It's going to be a real showstopper. And Artie goes, Hank, you don't open with a showstopper. So you don't open with a showstopper.
I got to tell you that anybody that named their album Waiting for Eldridge and it was actually Eldridge Goins.
Yeah.
Genius. So he produced the record?
He produced the record.
That's crazy.
I can't take credit for the name. It actually was, you know, when the universe intervenes and tells you what something's supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know Andy Skull Cheatham? She's the curator of the Hope Outdoor Gallery. She started Hope Farmer's Market.
Okay.
She's the art director on the record. And so I'm making this record in Eldridge's living room. Really nice studio he's got there.
Yeah. Oh, you didn't even use your own?
No. I couldn't get in it.
That's good.
Yeah. And you know, I realized when I first started a recording studio, it was to record my music. You know, this is 15, 20 years ago. I mean, this is the turn of the century.
Yeah.
And now, you know, all this time later, I realize how stupid that was to, like, I'm losing money if I'm recording my music in my studio, I went to Eldridge's on days that the studio was booked, you know, which thankfully is most of the time.
Right.
And so I started at least by not losing money, you know, that everything after that will be losing money. But the title, you know, so Andy would be checking in with me on the record, you know, how's it going? And it just so happened that most of the time my response was, and this isn't a knock on Eldridge, but my response was, I'm waiting for Eldridge. I'm waiting for him to schedule me. And Andy said, yeah, that's what we should call it. And then the same thing happened again to my girlfriend, you know. What's going on with the record? I'm waiting for Eldridge. You should call it that. And I said, okay.
Wow.
So, yeah, independent of one another.
Yeah.
So I said, all right, you know what? Yeah, you know. And it's something about it. It's, you know, Eldridge, it's just a great name.
Yeah.
He's a victim of having a great name.
It has a great name.
Yeah.
Hey, this is what I was going to say. It's a great album, man.
Mm.
And it's also...
You listened.
Yeah, I listened more than once. I know
I've
listened more than twice.
And what mood were you in when you listened to it? I know you're affected by the good mood.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't want to, I can't listen to music in a bad mood because I will hate it.
Right.
Even if it's like the greatest song ever written.
I heard you say that on one of I've listened to your podcasts. So I've heard you say that at some point.
I have.
But so I'm glad you're in a good
mood. I'm trying
to
think of a song that I hated when I heard it and then loved it more than anything. Like Creep Radiohead. I'm very sure that I hated that song when I first
Interesting.
The first time I heard it, it just hit me wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, there's music like that. Sometimes it just hits you like a square.
Yeah.
You know, but so, then the next time.
Here it is. This is a great, I categorize albums in my world as like when you put them on. Yours is a Sunday morning album.
Right
that
on.
Albums have to be organic, feel good, not hit you in a like, you know, I can't do like speed metal on a Sunday morning.
No.
I need something and it's great, man. It's a beautiful
I'm
album.
I'm very complimented.
There's a lot of there's a feeling that I get, and I'm not saying that you ripped anything off, but there's a feeling thing that you get from it that's very Simon and Garfunkel. Has anyone ever said that to you?
No, how long have you had these feelings, Johnny?
For a long time. No, I was thinking that today when I was listening to it.
I haven't heard that. I've heard Tom Waits, I hear Lou Reed, I hear Bob Dylan, I hear people say that.
Really?
But yeah.
I mean, I hear Tom Waits things in there.
Yeah.
And Dylan stuff.
Yeah. You know, it really depends on the track. It's a pretty diverse record to me.
It is. But it has an overall cohesive, organic, acoustic-based live drums.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and based in Americana.
You know,
do you call it that? What do you call it? Singer-songwriter dude?
I call it rock and roll.
I call it rock and roll, too.
But that doesn't mean anything anymore. Like, nobody knows
what
rock and roll is.
To me, Americana has taken the place of rock and
roll.
You
might be right.
Where guys play G.
Yeah.
You
know what I mean? That's me. I'm playing, you know, three chords, occasionally a fourth. I've heard Americana. It's rock and roll to me. You know.
Well, it's great. You did a great job.
I appreciate
it. What's the date of its release?
So it's going to be released on February 26th. Okay. We're going to perform the album from tip to tail at the Townsend, which is a place I know you've been frequenting.
Yeah, I actually was just texting with Steven.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, like 2 minutes before you called.
Yeah, so we're going to play the record. I got a really great band.
Who's it? Like, you got great guys on the record. Did Hauser play bass on the whole thing?
Yeah.
With the
exception of one track... the song Last Letter, Andre from my studio came over and played. Because it was like, it's like a replacement song. And so Andre's like, you know, it's still 1996 and indie rock is like the greatest thing in the world. And so I couldn't not invite him over to play on that, you know. But a lot of those decisions were Eldridge's. I mean, I approach it. So like as a producer, I'm mostly known in Austin as a producer.
Yeah, that's what I knew you as.
And this is the first of my own music that I've released since 2007.
Yeah.
So it's a better part of a decade.
By the way, well, I know we're going to get to this in a little bit, but I went back and it's hard to find Paper Moon
stuff. Yes, it is.
But I found your Sonic Bids page. And there's all kinds of shit on there, so I got to hear some songs.
Oh, that's
see
hilarious!
Some photos and read the bio.
I didn't even think to look there because I don't know where you would see. I was the curator of all that stuff.
Yeah, there's like five songs.
I had the Paper Moon website, and at a certain point, that was stuff that I just wasn't going to pay for anymore. We weren't a band anymore, and it just all went away. So.
Well, I wanted to see where you came from musically, but it's not that. It's not like you did an about face.
I don't think
so. You were a similar guy. It's an earlier version of this guy.
That's not a nice thought. I hope there's growth, which is all.
Yeah, totally. You can hear the growth.
Yeah, I want to do something interesting.
Yeah,
and that's really it. You know, as a producer, the song is in charge, and so as a writer, I try to have the same approach. I guess maybe not as a writer, as a performer, I should say, a performer in the studio. That, you know, I wrote the songs. What more do you want from me? And I would go to Eldridge. I gave Eldridge about, I don't know, 35, 45 songs that I had written between, you know, the end of Paper Moon, which is 2008 or 7.
Right.
And there was two songs I wrote in the studio with Eldridge, one I wrote on the drive to his house, one we wrote in the studio. And he went through all the other material and said, I like this, I don't like that. I gave it to him. I said, you choose. Don't make me do it. I like them all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and you know, to me,
I, were there ones that if you put them together made a certain kind of record, but if you took a couple songs out and put a couple other songs in, it made a different kind of record?
Yeah, so there were instances where we said, well, you know, I like this song too, but it's very similar to one we already have on the record.
Right.
You know, whether it was the, you know, particular rhythm of it or subject matter. And so, okay, let's find a different one, you know. And we were left with eight, so there were two more that had to be added. You know, at the end. So it was kind of a fun journey in that respect to kind of hash out some stuff that I had never recorded, and I'm always writing. So, you know,
do you write with artists that you produce?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah, quite often. You know, we're like often, you know, Andre and I team produce, you know, we co-produce everything.
And that's where things the same Sky Production.
Yeah. And we're the middle eight, you know? So like a lot of times we get a singer-songwriter that's got a great song, but
where's the bridge? Yeah. And maybe you scissor some things. Hey, maybe this needs a little something, like add a little something right here.
Absolutely. And I think it's something I believe in, like artists working with a producer.
Sure.
I think the DIY culture that has been born out of necessity in music, but it's a, you know, what are the chances that one human being is going to be a great songwriter, a great engineer, a great arranger, a great producer, a great show flyer maker, a great publicist, you know?
I did that once with a release, and it's fucking maddening.
Yeah.
And really the hardest part is mixing when you're just all by yourself. Like then all of a sudden you got to go to people's houses, or now you can email them stuff or whatever. Like, hey, please, I don't hear anything anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. My attitude was I was going to hand this over to Eldridge.
That's good.
Be the person I ask people to be when they come to my studio, you know?
But sometimes it is fun as an escape to go and do something like that, to go into a project and like, I'm going to lock myself in this room with just this stuff. And in 10 days, I'm going to put out whatever I can.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
That would be a real joy. And not a
that would be 10 days of reality, no income for me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not something I could unfortunately do. Yeah, I would love to, you know, go off into the wilderness and come back with a record, but you know.
Well, you did a great
job. I had Eldridge's house. Eldridge's living room is the wilderness, believe me.
I've been to one of his living rooms, but it was a while back. I think it might have been a couple of living rooms.
Brilliant musician. Awesome. You know, and really got what I was
doing.
Such
a great producer. And, you know, everything he does is its own thing. There's no Eldridge trip he lays on anyone that I've ever heard.
I don't think so, other than that vibe of a lot of layers. You know, he's really not afraid of piling things up. Yeah. And in a way that was effective to me, it worked for my music. Anyway,
I wonder, does he pay a lot of it? I mean, I know that he's can see an overall picture, but is there a cool, like, does he help so much, like with rhythms, with everything? Because he seems like he thinks like that. Like when I've jammed with him and stuff, he seems like he's thinking of, like, you know, Donnie Wynn.
I don't think I do.
They're just like, they're thinking not like just doom ba doom doom ba. There's like a ching doom round doom ching, you know.
Oh.
Also going on and enhancing that. You know what I mean?
Very idiosyncratic at first.
Uh-huh.
I remember cutting one particular track called Change. And Eldridge started, you know, I had done a little, you know, acoustic demo of it. And he started putting the drums together. And it's just, it made such little sense to me. And I'm a drummer and a producer, and I'm here. And I'm going, what is he doing? You know, and he kept layering drums, and you know, the last layer,
all made
was
sense.
The one.
Yeah, that's what Donnie does.
That's when it made sense.
Yeah,
and I love that about Eldridge. To me, he does everything backwards.
Yeah,
right. But therein is good collaboration.
Genius.
You know?
Yeah,
you know, he's we worked well together.
Yeah.
Because I was always very enthusiastic. What is he doing, you know?
Yeah.
What's going on over there? What is going on in his mind?
Where did you... You're from Boston?
Originally.
Born?
Yeah, I grew up on the South Shore.
All right. There you go, the accent.
Yeah, it comes out. And I was just home for the holiday, so it doesn't take long. A few beers, and it comes right out.
What was your family like? Like, were you... Like, Do you live in a rough part of town?
No,
Okay?
We lived in very nice Easton, Massachusetts, northeastern Massachusetts, picturesque.
What'd your parents
do? You know, they had coffee shops. So when
Really?
Yeah.
How cool.
It was. You know, they did really well with it. They recently sold their stores and are flirting with retirement. My folks, it's hard to imagine them sitting still. So I've been back to visit
like
a couple
barista?
Times.
Barista? Like, did all the... Did you have brothers and sisters? Like, did you guys have to bar? Like, did you guys have
well,
to
we
do
worked
some
at the
time
stores.
At the
it
stores?
It was more so on the construction side of things. I got this great education. You know, anytime they would open a new store or change something in the store, you know, my dad had two boys, and so that's what we would go and do. And you know, a number of times I fell for, you know, the demolition of something, and I would like, I'll do that, you know, grab a couple friends, and you know, we'd destroy the counters or something in a in a place, which is fun for about the first three or four swings of
right.
the mallet.
And then you realize
it turns into work real quick. But yeah, I learned a lot of carpentry skills, things like that from, you know, my dad did all those kind of things himself. We would go in and fix the place and paint the place and put in the counters.
Did you
like
start
that.
Playing there?
No. And it wasn't like that. At a certain point
in the 90s,
I think it was, his stores got bought out by Dunkin' Donuts.
Oh, okay.
And he stayed on, you know. But then all of a sudden it was like, now he had Dunkin' Donuts. And then he went from having a couple of them to having a bunch of them because that's their whole trip, you know.
Right.
So my dad was a musician, though.
Okay.
I've never heard him play a note. I've never heard him play. But he was in a band called A Bundle of Joy. And they opened for, at the time, they were called the Rascals. Now, I get all this, I got this
Not
information.
Not the Young Rascals.
Yeah, the Young, they were called the Young Rascals
But he
at
was
the time.
In the actual...
He wasn't in the band. He was in his band that toured with them.
Oh, okay.
Called
okay.
A Bundle of Joy.
Okay, that was the...
Yeah.
Okay.
And, but I hear, I've heard these things from, you know, an aunt or, you know, it's like, we haven't really had too many deep musical conversations. But I have this photograph. I have this one, like, press photo of him with the Bundle of Joy. And it's pretty cool. There's a big crowd. And he was a B3 player, you know.
Oh, cool.
And they were all wearing the same jackets, you know. And this singer had a
was
tambourine.
Was it, like,
it's very
60s?
60s. Yeah,
yeah,
very
cool.
Very late 60s, yeah.
Wow. And so what, he doesn't talk about it? Like, it was like Vietnam or something?
Yeah. I don't know if he was traumatized by it, but I think he's just the kind of guy that... you know, when he's not doing something anymore, he's not doing it anymore, you know. And very supportive of my music. They,
that's good.
Back in Boston, they used to come to my shows all the time. I'm sure they'll travel down to see this one, you know, now that they can. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, very supportive of my music. You know, it's funny. Yesterday, I went and played drums for Dave Madden at the airport. And I grabbed a stick bag, you know, and I just happened to look at it. And it said, the music machine... The Music Machine, Easton, Massachusetts, and it's the stick bag that I've had since I was 9 years old.
It is.
When they signed me up, he signed me up for drum lessons there at the Music Machine Studios, and I still have the stick bag. So it just popped into my mind now when you're, I don't often think or talk about, you
do
know.
Do you play
Easton.
A lot of gigs on drums?
Mm-mm. No, not often. Dave Madden
How is that? Let me ask
has
you
asked
this.
Me a few times.
Let me ask you this, because you, if you go from like not really playing a lot of gigs and then you have to go play a gig, like is it like, whoa?
Oh, and it's...
is it hard physically?
Yeah, it's hard. Well, not necessarily hard physically, but there's an anxiety to it that I get. That I'm really... I can play anything in the studio. I'm a rhythm guy. I'll play rhythm on piano, on organ, drums, guitar, whatever.
Did you guys have pianos and stuff when you were a kid?
Yeah, there was a piano in the house. And piano's great for kids to play. You know, you just space your fingers out a little bit and touch and it sounds great.
Yeah.
You know? So I you know, was writing songs as soon as I started making noise.
How did you... was there something that spoke to you, a moment or a song you heard or something you saw that made you go like, oh, I want to do that? Like, when did you decide that you wanted to be in music?
You know, I just loved music. I remember loving music as a little kid. And, like, I remember the first time I heard Beat It, you know, like on the radio. And I would sing at... At some point, I started playing the drums and, you know, really loved it and would jam with whoever and would
Did you want the drum? Did you ask for them?
Yeah. Or,
okay.
Well, actually, you know, I had, so this has got to be, oh, I don't know, what, fourth, fifth grade, whenever this transpires. But back then in Massachusetts, you studied music and they'd give you an instrument.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I remember waiting in this long line to go into the band room and get an instrument. And I was a pretty, I guess nowadays they'd give me ADD, yeah. You know. And so I kept getting in trouble and getting pushed to the back of the line, you know, back of the line. So I'm the last person to go in, and so what do you get? Trombone, you know, right? So I go home on the bus with a trombone.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm trying to play this trombone, and, you know, I think I had two or three times with the instructor, whose name I can't remember. But, you know, you'd say, blow, just blow, just make a sound, you know, and hold it as long as you can. And, it, you know, just to, and so he finally just took it away from me and handed me a pair of drumsticks.
Oh, wow.
You know, probably because much like I am now, my knee was shaking and I'm, you know.
Yeah.
And so that was it. I was off and running. You could bang on anything. I immediately put a set of pots and pans together in the basement and started doing that. And then I was off and running. At some point, it wasn't enough, and I wanted to, the music I was hearing in my head, I wanted to be able to play. So I just picked up the guitar, picked up the piano from there, no lessons.
Did your brother older or younger?
I have an older brother.
Older brother. Did he turn you on to music and like, did he do anything musically?
You know, he was, and he does. He has a home studio and he's into hip hop.
Oh, nice.
So he makes, hip hop records actually with a guy that used to be in Paper Moon with me.
Oh, wow.
The two of them kind of work together and they call themselves Spaceport Carnival.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, and they make some interesting stuff. And when I was a kid, when we were both living in the same house, it, you know, you and you're in middle school, you like what your older brother likes, right? I mean, and so he was really into hip hop. And so, you know, in the late 80s, I was really into hip hop music. Loved Tribe Called Quest, you know, Public Enemy, all those records.
Yeah.
I would listen to them over and over and over again.
Yeah, me too. I love that time. Hey, did you see Blowfly Died? Were you into Blowfly? Were you into Underground Soul? And
yeah, you
dirty
know, I just
funk?
I saw that. It's like they're really stacking up lately.
They are
it's
stacking
like you can't
up
go. I saw someone posted today, and you know, Animal, drummer for the Electric Mayhem, dead at 66, which would be too tragic to even think about.
I saw John D. Graham posted a thing that said, "Good morning, who died today?"
Oh, God. It feels like that, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, a lot of guys went down on Monday. I mean, I'm not laughing at that, but a lot of guys went down on Monday.
Well, you
like
have to have a
guys.
Sense of humor about it, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so you're into hip-hop. You got a drum set.
Yeah, and I'm recording it.
Okay,
you know,
on what?
So,
what'd you have?
So,
four-track cassette?
No, I had, of course, I had the Tascam 424.
Yes.
You know, cut my teeth on that. But I had a couple two-track reel-to-reel machines.
Oh,
so
cool.
The basement of my parents' house was kind of a graveyard for audio equipment because prior to owning a donut shop, my dad was, after the band, was a sound guy. Live sound.
Oh, cool.
He did live sound at a Cape Cod Melody Tent. I don't know if it's still called that, but places like that. And apparently back then, you could do that, kind of go from place to place and set up a sound system, and more venues would own their own sound system, and acts started traveling with their own sound guy. But I know he did sound for Bonnie Raitt, Stevie Wonder, and a lot of theater, a lot of musical theater, that whatever came through the venues that he had sound systems in, you know? So I would find stuff. I would find, you know, like a TAC two-track tape, you know, and then I would find a bit of tape and string it up. And
that's pretty cool.
And so pretty much it wasn't that much time between I started playing music to when I started recording music. You know?
Right.
And it's something I still do. I drove here from the studio from doing it today.
From recording today.
Well, I was, you know, editing. I'm overseeing editing. Andre's doing the heavy lifting. If he hears this, he'll be like, "You weren't doing shit."
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. My role over there lately has become... in the last number of years as producer and studio manager, you know, Andre's doing all the heavy engineering lifting and quite a job he's doing. So
do you like engineering Or do you guys have like the things that you're good at and you just kind of like...
They've kind of, I don't do it as much as I used to. And at one point in time, I loved it. And yeah, I would love to sit in, you know, a room. My first studio had, my first studio was, you know, like everyone else's, the Tascam 424. Yeah. But when I first started to acquire equipment, I had a Yamaha O2R and I was tracking to Hi8 tape.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, I would be locked away every available moment just working on it. And
so when did
anyone
you
who would come and record with me.
When did you have a band? Like a rock band? Was your first band?
First band, probably early high school, like freshman.
Yeah.
Freshman, sophomore in high school, playing with friends. We would play high school dances, parties, you know, the VFW, you know.
What were you playing? Like, were you playing
we
covers?
We were playing covers.
Let me think. What was the name?
The band was called Driftwood.
That's not embarrassing.
No, it's not that bad. It's not that the set list probably is, okay. If I can recall.
What years was it? Was it in the 80s or 90s?
No, this is early 90s. This would be early 90s. So what was popular then? I mean, we played some... I know we played a Green Day song or two. And Black Crows, yeah. We did Hard to Handle. We
kind of
that
classic
that
rock, like kind of what everyone kind of cuts their teeth on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure there was... Dylan, I'm sure we butchered Watchtower like everyone else.
Right,
and,
right.
You know,
I always forget that that's like a big song for people at the beginning.
Well, I mean, it is perfect.
It does.
As soon as you can move those, you know, the A minor, G, what does it have?
Yeah.
And then you don't have to do anything else. You can just keep doing that's the song.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, it's early in everyone's development, right?
Yeah.
Singer, songwriter.
So what were you listening to at that time? That kind of stuff? Like,
man, hip hop became slightly less interesting to me, and drumming, I got more into, jazz drummers.
Oh, really?
And I've always loved R&B music. So like, I was the kid on the bus who was, you know, everyone had Led Zeppelin t-shirts and was listening to the you know, Pearl Jam album, and right. I had, you know, like, you know, Take Six going in my Walkman, you know.
That's pretty good.
I wasn't the cool kid, but, you know, you like what you like. I mean, you listen to whatever it is that there was that same time period in the early 90s, I remember really liking the R&B music.
Yeah.
You know.
I remember having a hard time finding drummers during that time because everybody played like Dave. And just kind of that kind of dirge, that Dave Cruisin.
And that's kind of the thing, but he can do that.
Yeah.
If you start swinging your arms wildly, you know, you're not going to stay in time.
Yeah. You know, he was in this band, Unified Theory, that my band Gowdy toured with for a long time, like for a summer. And there was one night in like Myrtle Beach or something where we were hanging out, and I got drunk and he was totally sober. And then he asked me, we were talking, and then he was like, you sound like you don't really like that style of music. And I was like, man, I'm just getting like drummers. At that time, they were all playing this slow shit and all these fills and got real quiet. And he goes, sorry, man. It was awesome. Anyway, sorry. So, yeah, so you're playing that stuff. You're listening
to
that.
Yeah, I'm listening to that. I'm playing drums. I'm in a cover band. I'm doing all the things that I think, you know, lead you towards.
Was the dream alive then? Were you like, this is my life. This is what I'm going to do. Were you like, I'll do this, and then when I get out of college, I'll be like my dad, I'll go and...
Yeah, you know, I don't know how it's, you know, hard to connect to that guy and what he was thinking. I mean, at 17, you think you know everything, you know, so I probably at some point thought I was, you know, moments away from... Right. Success at
this. Yeah,
I mean, I've been playing for 45 minutes. I mean, yeah. Come on. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Surely David Geffen is going to knock on the door and hear what we're doing. I mean, this is. Have you ever heard Watchtower? I mean, we would go on and on. We played that song longer than anyone. So, but I've always loved it. I've always loved music, and I think any time I thought of something else, it didn't stick, you know.
Right. What were the other things that you would think of? Like, was there ever
Well, I mean, I loved playing basketball, but, you know, I mean, you know, you're only so good at basketball, and that's not as reasonable a career, you know. But I don't think I had business ambitions or anything other than, you know, music. I probably would have been a teacher if I didn't, you know,
stick with
music and keep plugging along with the recording studio. If I didn't find income at music, I probably would be not a music teacher, but a teacher, you know, of some kind.
Right. And so when did you go to college?
I did.
Where'd you go?
I started at Fordham University.
Oh, nice.
In the Bronx. And I think I was there 2 years and then finished at Stonehill College in Massachusetts. And but I didn't study music in school.
Did you get a degree?
I got a degree in religious studies.
Awesome.
Yeah, an odd path to record producer.
So are you a theologian?
I mean, there's a piece of paper somewhere that says that, but I haven't thought about, you know, I haven't kept up with the readings and things to be involved in that. But it was the stories that interest me, you know. It was, you know, the English department really would assign a reading, and I always felt like they had already made their mind up of what they wanted in reply. You know, read this book, and here's the questions, and these are the right answers.
Right.
Whereas that wasn't the case with religious
with
studies.
Philosophy,
religious studies. Here's this text, which is still, you know, remarkably interesting and has everything that Shakespeare has.
Yeah.
But there was this creative response to it. Whereas,
what do you think of this?
Yeah. And if you can go to the text, if you can go to the source, if you can back it up, it's completely valid. It doesn't matter that no one's had this thought about James Joyce before. We want a new thought about this. So
yeah, that's an interesting thing.
That's where I did well. And I had the chance to go to college, and it was one of those things where I felt like I should.
Yeah.
And you know, probably part of me thinking, well, if I do this, then, you know, I can go pursue my music and no one really can give me any shit about it because I went and
I did the thing. Yeah.
I have the paper. If everything fails, I can show someone the paper and they'll give me a job, right?
Yeah. Hopefully so.
as many people discover, that's not the case, right?
Right. So were you playing in college?
No, because when I went to New York, I didn't know anybody. So I went and played at some open mics just by myself. So I guess I was, but I wasn't in a band.
Writing songs.
Writing songs. And of course, I brought my 424 with me.
Yeah.
And I recorded all kinds of stuff in my dorm room and in the stairwell of the dorm. And actually met a guy there that ended up playing bass in a band with me. And experimenting. And this was... You know, this is pre-Giuliani New York, so here's a kid from the South Shore that, you know, goes to New York, and the first thing I did was, you know, take the train and go to Times Square. I mean, you know, and at the time it wasn't Disney World.
Now,
it was
peep shows.
It was peep shows and whores and junkies.
Yeah.
And, it was wild.
I never saw that.
I did. And, like, that was the first thing I did, you know? And there was, like, you know, there'd be a little storefront that would say, you know, IDs, you know?
Yeah.
And so you went in and you gave 20 bucks and you got a identification that said you were 21 years old, you know? And then you would go next door to whatever, you know, terrible establishment was next door.
Yeah.
And, you know, they didn't ask for an ID. You know, you just got taken for $25, you know, but they didn't, no one was going to ask you for an ID in pre-Giuliani New York.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, Ray Kelly and Rudy Giuliani just cleaned it up, sold it to Disney World.
Yeah.
It happened while I was there, you know, for the difference between, you know, New York in 97, I mean, in 95 and 97 is like unbelievable, you know? Yeah.
So, when you went back to Massachusetts, then you graduated, and what did you, then you started a band?
I graduated. You got the band going. Was touring with the band. You know,
but it was by Paper
that.
Moon.
It was Paper Moon. Okay. We were, you know, I mean.
So what'd you do?
At
you
a
guys,
certain point,
you guys
we were
for like 9 or 10 years.
We went after it for 7 years.
7 years. That's
you
a,
know, it started as
run.
You know, friends playing together, and you know, then at a certain point, there's new guys in the band, and then at a certain point, it's like a whole new band, you know, and you know, I'm sure it suffered from whatever band suffers from, and we were, you know, living together. And playing together, and everybody had their jobs or odd jobs or day jobs.
What kind of odd jobs would you do during that time?
Oh, man. So I was doing a couple of things. I was starting the studio, you know. I was starting Same Sky Productions. I probably filed paperwork for that in, like, 2001 for the first
time. Wow.
And it was an O2R and two Hi-8 tape machines, and I would go, you know, open mic nights, coffee houses, ask anybody who would come and record. Because there wasn't this like booming music scene on the South Shore of Massachusetts, and you could go into Boston, but even that wasn't, you know,
yeah,
wasn't like it was by then,
right?
You know, and there I remember there being a kind of like, well, you're a band from the suburbs, you know, like we're not going to book you. I remember at one point we got a. It's so funny to talk about this shit, Johnny. I haven't thought about this in forever. But we got a Cambridge P.O. box, you know, just so when
so
we mailed stuff.
Like
we weren't the guys from the suburbs. You could book us at a cool place, you know. And by the time we put our third record out, which is probably what you found, the 5-song EP, okay. You know, we were selling out the upstairs at the Middle East. We had done that a couple times. That's like 250 people.
Yeah.
Well, then they wanted to move us downstairs, which is like 700 people.
Yeah.
You know? And I remember like saying, well, I don't want to, like, who are we opening for? Like, I don't, you saw like at our best, we can bring about 200 people. Right. And that's only happened twice.
Right.
Why would you move us downstairs, you know? Oh, no, it'll be great. We're putting you on with 6 other bands, you know? I was like, well, but who's the big act that's going to draw the beat? It's going to be great. And so, of course, our first appearance downstairs was, you know, maybe 50 people there, you know?
Yeah.
And at the end of the night, you know, I'm getting yelled at. But, you know, this was a terrible night, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going, I didn't even want to do it. Like, what are you talking? I told you, what are you doing moving us down here? It was as everyone knows that does this, it's a real uphill struggle.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that was about as much success as Paper Moon had, you know. Great friends, and I remember fondly the music, and I don't think the music was the problem. You know, I thought we did pretty good.
No, it's good.
But it's been since then that I've released anything of mine, and this is my first album under my name as a solo. You know, I wrote a lot of the songs for Paper Moon, but I was a member of a group. I mean, it was a thing that we were doing together, and it had a sound that band could make, you know.
If you were doing this with them, they'd be here with you, probably. It would just be you.
Exactly. Yeah. And I always liked that idea of being in a band, you know. We're a band, man, you know. Like, we could get in a pickup basketball game, you know. There's enough of us.
There was a thing that happened to me, like, when I was a kid. It was specifically the movie Help, and I was like, wait, they all live, like, in rooms, like, next to each other, and they just, like, fucking goof around all day and meet chicks and then go play shows. Like, I mean, I love music so much, but I was like, yeah, that's the kind of thing I want to get into, like, hanging with your buddies and just, like...
Oh, yeah, it's the greatest...
Fucking around all the
it's
time.
It's the greatest dream, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and... you know, we had our go at it, but there's only
Did
so much you
can do.
Did you
guys have a van
there.
And you toured that whole Northeast area?
We would rent a van to go and play in New York, and we played in Vermont. And
you know what? Is it the Paradise? Is that the place that has a big room and
yep.
a thing, and then a little room with a bar? A little smaller stage?
There's a few places like that. Paradise is one of them.
Okay, yeah, I played there.
Yeah.
and I played Bill's Bar a few times in the Middle East. But Bill's Bar more than once.
Bill's Bar we used to enjoy playing, especially when there was a game. You know, if there was a Sox game, it would be packed. And what I remember about Bill's Bar mostly is, you know, of course, when we played there, you could still smoke in there.
Yeah.
And just, you know, it'd be the winter, and it would be packed with people with big coats, walking around with lit cigarettes, you know?
Yeah.
And I, at the time, I had, you know, hair long down to the middle of my back, and I just remember, you know, showering after those gigs and just like, I mean, I bet it was brown water coming up, just the smoke that would be stuck. But I mean, I was smoking too, so.
Me too.
I don't anymore.
Not me. I mean, I do. So, okay, so what brought you to Austin? What were you, I mean, it's a music town, but like, how had you been here? Did you guys come down here for South By or something?
No, not as a band. It had really nothing to do with the band. It was just, you know, my time to move.
Right, but what? Know. Why here?
So, well, I was dating someone at the time.
Oh.
Yeah, there's always a girl, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we were pretty unhappy. We had been together about 4 years or 5 years. We were living together in Boston and pretty unhappy, and she was very unhappy there in Boston. My band had just fallen apart, you know. The studio, I had to have two other jobs to keep the studio going. And it was, let's get out of here was the, well, let's just get out of here. And I thought about Nashville, thought about New York. I'd already tried New York a couple times and come right home to lick my wounds, you know. First in college and then again trying to gig there. And never liked Nashville that much. No offense to Nashville. Visited it a few times. Never cared for it. And she had family in San Antonio. So Austin, okay. I'll move the studio to Austin.
It's a music place.
A music place. And if I fall flat on my face, she's got family in San Antonio. We'll go there.
Yeah.
You know? And of course, you know, we get here about, I don't know if it was a month, 2 weeks or a month. But once we moved here, we decided we were not going to be together anymore, you know. And here I was with everything I owned, you know.
In a totally strange... And now you didn't have the family to fall back on.
I didn't have... well, I had Andre.
Okay.
You know, which is... I've always got Andre.
Yeah.
You know. We had one conversation about... Andre... So Andre... This is Andre Cantav, the engineer at Same Sky Productions, my recording studio. And I recorded Andre's band, I don't remember when... You know, 15 years ago, he was in a punk band called Moso, and I recorded their band, and Andre just never left. He never left the studio.
That's cool.
And so I eventually had an employee.
Yeah.
You know, and then I was giving Andre more responsibilities, and he was covering sessions, and you know, I said to him, "Hey, man, you know, this just isn't working here. We're gonna move the studio to Austin. How's that sound?" He went, "Right on, man. That's cool." And that was it.
That was it.
And that was it. That was the one conversation we had about it. And he came with us. So it was like, well, we're here. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And best thing that has ever happened to me. Best thing that's ever happened.
How did you guys get work to start off with?
Would
you
Same start going way out we to always bands? Did.
Going out and seeing bands?
Going out and seeing bands. Now, that the first studio was right at 8th and Congress.
Oh, wow.
You know, and it was, so we found there was an ad agency, Stanhope Group Advertising, and they had the fourth floor of the historic Hogg building right there at 8th and Congress.
Right.
And it had this terrace overlooking the Capitol, everything. And they had a little room built out in there that they had a guy that was doing jingles for them.
Right.
But the guy took off or something. I mean, that's not what they said, but you could tell when you walked into the room, like, you could tell someone moved out in the middle of the night,
right?
You know? And so they were looking to. We just stumbled upon it and sublet that little space, and that was our studio.
Did somebody else move in after you, like a guy?
I don't know,
because I remember playing like a fundraiser or something for the Paramount, and that guy hanging out and him being like, "Hey, come on over across the street. We're gonna party." But it seemed like a party scene more than a, "Hey, come check out my studio."
Right. And, you know, it was a difficult place to run a studio because
I couldn't work during the day.
No, hardly ever, you know. And we couldn't get a lease that would allow me to, you know, try to put any money into building it out to be able to do that. I don't know how long we were there, 3 or 4 years. But in that time, the building had two or three different owners. It went into foreclosure. and none of the owners nor the bank wanted us there anyway, you know. So it is basically the whole time I was there, I was looking for another place for the studio. But we were right there on 8th and Congress, so we would set up, you know, we just have it set up. We'll go downtown. We just had to walk and
when
see
you
a band.
Into this place, the place now, is that Second?
Second, yeah. We're on Second Street now, and it's only about a mile and a half from the other place.
Yeah,
but. Jesus, Johnny, I think that was, 2011,
okay.
End of 2011 to 2012, we started doing sessions over there. I could be off. My memory is not great. I could be off by a year, but that first studio was a trip, but it was really more of a, we made some very cool records there, but it was also a real showroom of sorts, and like it was a great place to host an event.
Yeah.
So we would do a lot of that, you know. We had parties in there.
Right.
Sometimes the rent was paid by parties.
That's good.
You know.
Yeah.
But that was just the dynamic there. That's what it was.
How do you guys live there? Do you and Andre live on the site where your studio is?
At the compound now, yeah. Yeah. The studio, so it used to be a church.
Okay.
And so the church building, we converted to the studio, and there's you know, a little 1,200 square foot bungalow where we live.
Yeah.
So we've got that terrible commute across the parking lot.
Yeah. How late do you work? Are you late? Are you early? I
Not
see you
anymore.
On the trail all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, I'm
morning.
An early guy now. I like to do sessions at the studio from 10 to 6. You know, I think you can get everything you need done.
I think so too.
In an 8-hour day. And I know that's, you know, new for recording studios. The 10-hour day or the 12-hour day is still the,
well,
you know.
Sometimes when you push it, if you go 12 hours, the 4 hours you worked after the 8 are usually not as...
They're not as productive.
Not as great.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, the real tricky thing about recording music, whether as the performing artist, as the engineer or the producer, is that magic can happen at any moment.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes, yeah, the 13th hour might be when everything happens. But, you know, after 15 years, you know, I think if you prepare a little bit,
yeah,
that, and we like to work fast. I think a good engineer's job is to really not be noticed, just to be out of the way.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
So when we do that well in 8 hours, you can accomplish a lot. And if you're booking a few days in a row, you know, you have a place to start the next day. You know,
yeah.
Which is really, it's good to be able to walk in and know what you're picking up from, you know.
Who all have you had in there lately?
Well, right now we're doing a record for, well, we just, actually, I was just meeting with Dave Scher Trio. We finished that. We were just kind of listening to the final edits today.
Did you record that live? Because you're, is that a jazz band?
No. Dave Scher, what we did with him is not jazz.
Okay.
It's, you know, rock or rock country.
You have a great room for people to record live.
Yeah.
I mean, you do have a great room.
I prefer
room.
To track people live,
yeah.
You know, as live as you can.
Yeah.
But it all comes down to the budget of the people working,
sure.
And, you know, the reality of the modern studios, that things are getting chopped up and edited. And so you in some ways, you know, isolation is a necessity for that, you know. But we've got a big enough room that we can, you know, isolate the amps in a separate room but have everybody playing together for
sure.
for the vibe. But
yeah.
Well, I want to tell you about Waiting for Eldridge.
Yeah,
John.
Tell me more.
Well, what haven't I told you?
I think you told me a lot of stuff about it. I think people just need to hear it. You had Gary Newcomb, you had Dave Madden, you had the great Steve Bernal.
Oh yeah,
who
he
I
did
love.
Cello
I had him on the
tracks.
Show. You know, when he first heard me talk about him on this show, he got mad at me.
What did you say?
I told him I was naming all the things I learned from musicians that I worked with, and then I was like, there's people that I learned stuff about being on tour with, and the person was like, what? And I was like, Steve Bernal taught me how to walk my bar tab. With authority. Like, laugh in the face and just turn around and walk away. And as they're yelling, you just keep on walking like a man.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And he got really mad. But then he came on the show and he was cool. Because, I mean, Steve was, you didn't know him then. But
no.
In like the early 90s.
I didn't know him then.
He was insane. And he has moved very far from that and doesn't want to, which I totally understand. If
sure.
I, you know.
But we all anyway. Have that transition.
Yeah.
You know? We've all had those years.
Yeah.
I think. I'm assuming you did.
Yeah. I didn't. You know what? I think mine were weird. Mine were like late 30s. Was, I think, kind of when I became like kind of like wilder, I guess. Is that weird?
More wilder?
Staying out all
more
night.
More wilder?
Yeah. Just being weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
But now I've just gotten settling into my age bracket.
I see you on the trail in the mornings.
I know. I used to be up all night and up super early in the morning. I cannot do that anymore.
Yeah.
I go to sleep at a reasonable hour. Okay, so look, let's talk about waiting for Eldridge.
Let's do it.
Now I feel bad. I feel like maybe we were just talking too much crap.
No,
I'm just joking. Forgive me for interjecting. You just took control of my show. You're producing my show.
I can't turn it off, Johnny.
Okay, so you and Dave
Hank,
Madden do
you don't
a lot of
open
stuff.
With a showstopper.
That's right.
Dave Madden, my platonic friend, Dave Madden.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm futzing with your...
He's a fantastic dude. Great musician. He moved here from up there. Did you know him up there?
No, but he was in Boston at Berkeley, but our paths never crossed. Okay. I wasn't a Berkeley student, but he...
I met him on tour. I think I met him in Delaware.
For real?
I think so.
I just played the airport with him yesterday. Madden's fantastic, and he played the record. He played on a couple songs on the record, but he also arranged an overture for the album for string quartet.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and we actually cut that at Same Sky, because that's kind of like just a little special thing we're going to share with people that come to the show. It's not
cool.
on the record.
Okay, cool.
I've just been using it in some promotional materials.
And also you had the great Bob Ludwig.
He mastered
the record.
Yeah, that was a trip. I actually... You know, went up to Portland to accompany the master because, you know,
well, when
the
it's a
chance
guy like
to go
that,
to
you
Bob's
wanna,
studio,
yeah.
Eldridge came too. The two of us went up there and we tore up Portland that night. We flew in and we flew in hot, like an hour before the session. You know, went to the session after the session, went out, tore up this really peaceful, nice city, and flew back.
What's it like working with a guy like that? Do you get to...
A guy like Bob?
Yeah.
He was so sweet, dude.
Yeah?
So sweet. And it's like a... I mean, it's a family operation over there. You know, his wife is like the manager, and their employees all seem super happy, and Adam, the other engineer. And so we got there and, you know, worked about, you know, I don't know, 4 hours. It was around noon. And they took a lunch order, and we all sat around a big table and ate lunch together. And
that's cool.
It was really great. Very welcoming, super helpful people. And obviously Bob, you know, is just, his ears are fantastic. And
it's cool to sit around with a dude. Like I've got to work with George Marino. You know that guy?
Oh, yeah.
And I got to spend the day with him.
I mean, that's part of why you do it, right?
Yeah.
I mean.
I did one with Howie Weinstein, but no hanging out.
And so Bob has mastered... like most of the records I love.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I guess he's mastered most of the records, you know. But
did he do Sgt. Pepper? No.
No.
He's not that far
No,
back.
He's not that far back. But
who cares who mastered Sgt. Pepper?
Yeah.
What's wrong with
to me, it's the like. So, I mean, he mastered Einstein on the Beach, the Philip Glass opera. And I got to talk to him about that. And. He was telling me how freaked out he was when he first heard the tracks because no one, you know, told him what it was. And if you've heard it, it's, you know, pretty extensive 4 hour, you know, of arpeggiated noodling, you know. and so we, you know, I got to chat with him about that. And then he had he was just working on something in surround sound for Philip. And so he said, check this out. And he pulled out the speakers, you know.
Yeah.
He's got this like an incredible control room, you know, mastering room. But, you know, you open these drawers and the speakers come out from the back. And he put this, you know, thing he was working on in surround sound and totally let us chill and listen to it. And it
That's awesome.
Super special. Yeah. Like really sweet guy. And he did a phenomenal job mastering the record. He seemed to get it and not try and fix it. You know, there was a lot of information there on the record. There's a lot happening that, you know, I can imagine some mastering engineers would want to get in there and start carving more.
Sure.
I didn't get that sense from him.
I can't tell. I mean, I can tell when I hear of something mastered or not mastered, but to me, it's like the engineer. Like, if that guy did his job, then I'm not going to be like,
right,
who mastered this?
You know? Exactly. You know, I have that experience from hearing it, you know, on Eldridge's speakers in my car, in my control room, in my right. environments, and then, you know, and then going up to Portland and then hearing what Bob did to it.
Yeah.
And then the various versions of that. So it's like, you know, I've been listening to it, just the, you know, the reference files.
Right.
And I had those on my phone. And, you know, you plug your phone goes Bluetooth to your car. Or
right.
However, you know, you listen to music. But then actually getting it on a disc and appreciating a difference, you know.
How do you listen to music? How does Dave Messier listen to music?
Mostly on most of the music I listen to is being played in my control room.
Right.
You know?
That's what most people say.
Yeah, and right. And so what's happened to me is that after a day of doing that, I'm not in a rush to hear more music. I listen to the news, you know? When I put music on, nowadays I like to, you know, open the XM radio app and just pick some esoteric station, leave it on while I'm washing the dishes or whatever, and I don't know what it is. I don't know who it is. No one asked me to listen to it. I'm not taking notes. I'm not writing down the arrangement. I'm not even gonna walk over to the phone and look and see who it is. It's just, you know, the Latin jazz that's accompanying my cooking. I don't listen like I used to, you know, when you just stay up all night digging into a record and listening to it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Like I did with so many records, but it's hard to do that now.
Yeah. There's a thing I noticed. I don't get a record and then like just lie down and listen to it. If I do, I'll, you know, on the trail, like that's the most immersive I get in music where then there's nothing else.
What do you listen to while you're on the trail?
Stuff that people, whoever's coming in, whoever sent me some stuff, friends of mine who have new stuff, then also just my bank of like, you know, Cheap Trick or, you know, whatever it is. Cause I mean, I have some favorite musics and bands that I do like listen to regularly. Like I listen to Jackson Brown. I listen to My Bloody Valentine. I listen to Cheap Trick.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
And they're going in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I know, but there's a big thing amongst, well, at least in the band Skyrocket, that is Rick's son going to play drums because Bun is suing them? And there's a whole thing going on.
That happens a lot at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Listen, man, that is for the fans. And I'm a fucking fan. Are you a fan? Like, are you a fan?
I can't say I'm
like a fan of music.
Yeah, oh,
like
absolutely.
A fan. Like, you got your band, whoever your Cheap Trick is.
Right.
That's your, you know.
Absolutely.
I've passed on meeting Cheap Trick before because I thought I was going to fucking cry when I met them. Honestly. Like, that's what a fan I am.
Yeah.
I was scared that I would lose it.
That's interesting. So you never did?
No.
Never did. They just played Fun Fest.
Yeah,
I know. That was actually the first time I saw them live.
They're still really good.
Oh, unbelievable.
Unbelievable
Rick
band.
Rick is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robin, unbelievable singer, and he's like 60 now. 60
and
something.
You know what? And he's doing it right. For his age, he wasn't like, you know, trying to be 22.
He's not screaming as
much? Well, no, I mean, I guess, you know, he's just wearing, he had like this really cool hat and nice outfit, and he was standing with a commanding presence, you know, and not trying to act like a 25-year-old.
Right.
You know?
He didn't look weird for his age.
Right. That's it's good. Not like, you know, some other guys.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of you talking about me because I'm wearing skinny jeans. Hey,
no, I'm not talking about you, Johnny.
outside of the show on February 26th at the Townsend, do you have some other stuff lined up? Do you have some plans for South by Southwest?
No, I don't. I'm not participating in that, but, you know, I'm going to get out and play more.
Do you guys do something, a same sky party or something?
No, we had in the past, but we've been very fortunate the last few years that...
be working.
Yeah, that we're booked. And, you know, we're booked now for all through South By. So it's a, you know, the first few years I moved down here, I was like trying to participate in South By. And you know, that's spending money. And then now I've kind of learned that, no, it's make money time.
Yeah.
It's make money time. Stay home and make money.
Yeah.
So don't participate in it. But I'm looking forward to playing more shows. I've got to say, I've put so much effort into this one.
Right.
And it's really the beginning again. I haven't been on this side of it in the better part of a decade. And a lot has changed. I mean, I produce records for people, and then they leave with the records. I mean, I'm not involved on the other side of it. And I got to tell you,
it's all just starting for you.
Yeah, so I've had to just do these, you know, the horrific task of writing a bio for yourself. I mean, is there anything more?
You did it yourself?
Yeah,
I've never been able to. I always have people do it.
Well, I sat down to do it, and of course you can't. And then I was flipping through a magazine, and I saw an advertisement for a tag watch. How do you even say it? Tag?
I don't know.
Tag.
I've never been able to say
tag
it. Yeah, I had one at one point, and I still didn't know how to say it.
I'm reading this, ad for the watch, and the language that they're using is just like, it's the same kind of language they use to sell like luxury cars. You know? The subject of continuous improvement, and you know. And
it's a fucking watch.
Yeah. And so I just said, well, fuck it. That's my bio. And I just copy and pasted the watch ad.
Yeah.
And, you know, removed the watch and put my name in its place. So it took, you know, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But
that's pretty smart.
And I didn't have to deal with it. I mean, I don't have a publicist. I don't. I'm doing this myself. And for the experience of doing it.
How do people find it? Like, do you have a website?
There's a website.
Okay, what is it?
DavidMessier.com.
Okay.
At the moment, I think it's a, you know, very simple splash page. But, you know, that'll be where and the music will be on iTunes, you know, it'll be everywhere. It'll be available.
Going to do Spotify and
I think so. I think it's going to be everywhere. And at Waterloo Records, you know,
okay,
I would definitely
physical ones.
Encourage people to support the local record stores.
And you'll be selling it at your show Saturday, February 26th at the Townsend.
Yeah, yeah. You can get the tickets at the Townsend's website, which I think is thetownsendaustin.com or...
I don't know. You know, nowadays you don't even need to know the words. You just type in the thing and it goes to a place and it says, you mean this? You're like, yeah, this.
Yeah, and and the album will be out there. It'll be available on iTunes. But get a physical copy. Go support a local place if you can.
Yeah.
And I'd love to share it with you. So,
did you put some work into that art and stuff?
Andy Skull Cheatham, the art director, and I should credit also Matt McGill, a really talented graffiti artist who did the album layout, and Cameron Paris Cloud, who took the album cover photograph.
Okay.
All did a wonderful job. Again, I gave it to Andy and said, what does this look like?
Yeah.
I'm not a visual artist, you know. You tell me.
You know, I talked to somebody one time years and years and years ago, and they were like, I was in this, I've got to be involved in every single thing, aspect of it, and I should be the main guy doing every single thing. And they were like, man, you know, Madonna's not a musical genius, right? I'm like, yeah. They're like, you know, Madonna's a genius lies? I'm like, yeah. She knows what other people do better than her. And that's why she's fucking where she is.
Find those people, right?
Yeah. You got to find people that are good at what they do.
You know, yeah, and I would encourage all musicians to do that, you know. And there's people you can find that aren't, it's not like you have to have a $20,000 budget.
And in music, too, in one of those Bowie articles, someone was talking about the genius of him. Like, they were asking somebody, like, when you worked with him, was he like a taskmaster? And they were like, no, the thing about that dude was that he got you because he liked what you did, and that's what he wanted you to do.
Yes, do your thing.
Yeah.
You know, do your thing, do something interesting. If we have fun, they'll have fun. You know, I took the same approach to this as I try to encourage people to take when they're in the studio working with me, you know? And it's like, I kind of, like, when I'm taking on a new project as a producer, or this project that I'm doing as an artist, I kind of have, like, so there's three rules, okay? You know, rule number one, don't be afraid.
Right.
Rule number two, let it be new. And rule number three, be bold.
Yeah.
And so people can get over their fears. The second one, let it be new, that's where I notice a lot of musicians in the studio struggle. Yeah. It's like, no, but it goes like this.
Right.
It's like, well, you're playing it like that, and it's really not moving.
Right.
You know, like
that demoitis thing. Where
yeah.
they're just stuck in
you
the
can't
thing
beat
that
a
they,
demo. Yeah. I've learned that too. If someone comes in and tells me how much they love their demo and they want it, but they want to record it, I go, I'm not touching it.
Yeah.
You can't beat a demo. You can't. Don't touch it. If you like it so much, put it out.
Yeah.
You know, but the attitude of letting it be new, you know, let it become something else. I find a lot of people that come into the studio are trying to recreate a moment.
Right.
But the trick is to have a new moment.
Right.
You know, and so that's why I just gave this to Eldridge. I just said, what do you want to do?
That's good.
We would start playing together. And so, I don't know, I would hum something and that would become the bass line, or he would, and that would become a horn part. And,
yeah.
And it just kind of built organically from there.
Now, I know it's not even out, and you haven't gotten like the putting it out in the world for judgment and to be kicked around, ignored, praised, or whatever the hell's going to happen to it. But are you thinking like, oh, I'm going to do another one?
Well, I'm not going to stop writing songs.
Right.
And in fact, that's been one of the struggles with trying to rehearse this album, is like when I pick up the guitar to rehearse it, I write a new song, you know, and then I want to play that.
Yeah.
I don't want to, like, why do I have to play these other ones? You know? And plus, this took me, I mean, I spent, this has been 24 months.
Yeah.
I mean, this album was mastered last January.
Yeah, you gave me a link to it a while back.
But I needed all that time. I mean, I'm last on the list, you know. It's everything that's going on at the studio, artists I'm producing, and then whatever time is left over is for, you know, this effort I'm making to reemerge as a singer-songwriter, you know.
Right.
So, but I think that came from the experience of doing this for 15 years, too, that you need a lot of time. It's okay to go slow.
Yeah.
It really is. And another real treat that came about with this is Fable Records is putting the album out. Mike and Laura Mordecai's record label is going to put the record out. And so I'm excited about this next year in that, you know, booking some more shows with them and getting out and playing more. And I think that will, I hope that leads to another record. If I'm alive, I should make another one.
Yeah, don't get caught up in this death wave.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, is there anything I'm missing? People can get out and pick this up. I guess I'm going to put this out like in the week of the album.
That would be great,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'll do. So it's in the future from now, but people can pick it up February 26th at the Townsend. You can find it online at davidmessier.com. The album is Waiting for Eldridge. My guest is David Messier.
Johnny, thank you so much.
Dude, thank you so much for coming. You're a great guy. I love seeing you on the trail.
Yeah.
I feel like we're better than the other music people in town.
You made a comment to me once because you had just seen Andre, you know, whatever, at some mile marker on the trail.
Yeah,
and then you saw me and you're like, you guys must be the healthiest studio.
Yeah.
I was like, if only. Trying.
It balances it out.
Yeah. All right. I look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Cheers.
See how we ride. Take all of my love, girl. Go outside.
There you go. David Messier, his new album, Waiting for Eldridge, out Friday, February 26th. You can find him at the Townsend doing a release show. Look that up at davidmessier.com. Okay, he's got some dates on there. He's got whatever you got going on. Go out there, check it out. Eldridge Goins did a great job. David Messier did a great job. All the players did great jobs. It's a great record, so check it out. All right? Hey, while you're out there checking out David Messier, don't forget you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can like us on Stitcher. Get a new show every Tuesday, every Friday. If you like it, share it on Facebook and Twitter. You can like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? Just get involved. Help us out. Spread the word, all right? Thank you so much for listening. Let's hear some more music from David Messier and his new album, Waiting for Eldridge. All right, go out there and check him out, davidmessier.com. Have a great day. Let's get down.
Someday the people I see on TV will be uglier than me. And the fastest car will lag behind, this jalopy of mine. And the latest shoes will be old news to the ones on my feet. And when the ladies dance to make romance, they'll do it to my beat. And the latest trend will never end, all because of me. And my old clothes will strike a pose on the hanger and me. And when you see me walk, you'll hear them talk, oh how they wish that they could be. And when the ladies dance to make romance, they'll do it to my beat. come around.